This is BBC Radio 3. It's 6:15. And now, the Sunday feature.
Radio 3 presents a Periscope production of a David Perry feature, Looking for Stanley. The true and shocking story of reclusive film director Stanley Kubrick, featuring previously unheard audio of Kubrick's voice snatched from the ether. Looking for Stanley is written by John Baxter.
It's no small thing to record a human voice. For this program, we assembled top audio engineers from around the world and took their advice on the perfect microphone. They chose the Audio Technica AT4033SM. Its superior linear off-axis response proved to be best suited to the waveforms of my voice. Each link has been re-recorded at least 40 times to get...
Thank you, John, with a different emphasis on the last phrase. Thank you.
If Stanley Kubrick was directing this program, and not some journeyman, I would do it again, and again, and after that yet again, 50 or 60 times, and after that the next link, and the next. If it's worth doing, argues the creator of Dr. Strangelove, A Clockwork Orange, 2001 A Space Odyssey, and Full Metal Jacket, it's worth doing often. From the world's greatest living filmmaker, one would expect nothing less.
He's a total perfectionist, and I think that that's the only way that you can make a film. You have to start out on the basis that everything is going to be right. We know, in fact, that it can't be. But at what point you compromise is at what point you start to crumble. I think Kubrick's have all been obsessive projects.
It's Stanley Kubrick. It's 6:54 p.m. Thursday. Could you give me a ring when you get in, whatever time it is? Thanks.
The rarely recorded voice of the great man. Having retreated to Britain almost 40 years ago from an America imperiled by nuclear war, Kubrick has lived in rural Hertfordshire, giving no interviews, entertaining few friends, sleeping all day but working at night when he can deal with the Californian film studios that fund his work. Working under this regime, he's managed to recreate in Britain the post-millennium future of 2001 A Space Odyssey, the wartime Vietnam of Full Metal Jacket, the 19th century Europe of Thackeray and Barry Lyndon, the snowbound mountains of Oregon in The Shining, and, most recently, New York City for his forthcoming sexual thriller, Eyes Wide Shut. Making films under such conditions demands a prodigious effort of will. But will is a commodity which Stanley Kubrick has never lacked. His school friend and later collaborator, Alexander Singer.
It was astonishing. Most of us were worried about whether our flies were open or closed, and Stanley may have been worried about that too, but there was a sense of organized activity directed at a goal that is, to put it mildly, uncommon with teenagers.
Born in the New York suburb of the Bronx, the son of a prosperous physician, Kubrick grew up in comfort. His father gave him his first camera and taught him chess. Both would become lifetime obsessions. Alan Kaufman knew Kubrick as a young dropout in Manhattan.
He was a quiet, shy kind of a guy, but when he got him going talking about movies, he told you about the movies he was going to make. I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do that, and I'm going to make movies. And generally speaking, people didn't believe him. And it sounded like just another young man with a boastful ideas. And thinking about him, he was skinny, and he was dark, and sometimes he'd wear an old suit, you know, a baggy suit and a shirt without a tie. He looked introverted and quiet, you know. Unimpressive, I would say.
Straight out of high school, Kubrick landed a job on Look magazine, a remarkable achievement for a 17-year-old. From 1948 to 1951, he was one of their top photojournalists, sent to cover senators stumping the sticks or young movie stars like Montgomery Clift. But 3 years were enough. Deciding that if he could take still pictures, he could surely make movies, Kubrick quit and retreated to Greenwich Village, where he hustled chess games at 25 cents a time to buy food. He made a few short films, then ran into a wealthy young producer, James Harris. Kubrick had a story to tell, and Harris thought he could help him tell it.
I have to combine Fear and Desire and Killer's Kiss, because I felt, in a way, that both of them were tremendous examples of a potential, of an incipient genius. I felt that Stanley was on his way to being a terrific filmmaker. That I was more impressed with the fact that he had done what he did, completed these pictures, than I was actually with the films themselves.
Together, Harris and Kubrick made a slick thriller, The Killing, and the First World War drama, Paths of Glory. Neither film found easy answers to the riddles of crime and war. But Kubrick wasn't looking. He liked war and crime. Soldiers and criminals had, he said, the virtue of being for something or against something in a world where many people have learned to accept a grey nothingness. Such a man wasn't afraid of taking on even the most unconventional project. Not even Vladimir Nabokov's Lolita. How did they ever make a film of Lolita? The answer to the film's advertising slogan was, of course, they didn't. Even Kubrick, always audacious, ducked the pedophilia theme. His chosen star, 15-year-old Sue Lyon, acted 18 and was, as one critic remarked, not a potential anything. She was already there. Kubrick's Lolita is really about the besotted Humbert, played with seedy grandeur and wounded continental class by James Mason. Initially, Mason refused the role, so Harris suggested one of the stars of Kubrick's Spartacus, Sir Laurence Olivier.
He brings him back to our bungalow, and we have lunch in the bungalow and discuss it with him, and he agrees to do the picture. He says, all I have to do is tell my agents, who is MCA. Incidentally, they were ours, too. Stanley comes back later that evening after shooting, and he says, Larry came up this afternoon on the set and whispered in my ear that he's not going to do it. But I never forgave the agency for that, because it was a big blow to us. I mean, having him leave our lunch saying, yes, I'm doing it, I just have to tell the agents. I'm sure they must have said, Sir Laurence Olivier cannot do Humbert Humbert. You could jeopardize the blah, 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 blah. So, you know, we at that point didn't say anything to MCA, but in our minds we had discharged him.
Lolita was made in England. Kubrick liked the place. His partnership with Harris amicably dissolved. He relocated here with his new wife, Christiane, who played the German girl at the end of Paths of Glory. He was not to leave again, except under the most stringent duress. His focus contracted to Christiane, his three daughters, and a succession of walled estates in the English countryside, from where the doings of mankind, even at their most anguished, seemed trivial. The stuff, in fact, of comedy.
We'll meet again. Don't know where. Don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
Dr. Strangelove, or to give it its full title, Dr. Strangelove or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, showed a Kubrick who, if he didn't exactly love the bomb, had at least stopped worrying about it. His nightmare comedy, as he called it, proceeded from a genial contempt of everyone from the President of the United States to the crew of the B-52 leper colony roaring with patriotic single-mindedness on its mission of mass destruction. Even on such shifting planes of reality, Kubrick knew what he wanted. His art director, Ken Adam.
He was watching me draw. He said, why did you choose that triangular shape? And I said, why? I don't know. It just came to me. And so he said, wait a moment, triangle is the strongest geometric form, isn't it? I said, yeah, I think it is. He said, how are you going to treat the walls? I said, well, we could do it as reinforced concrete. He said, so like a giant bomb shelter. I said, yes. He said, that's great. So I was in business. But what it really, right at the beginning of my relationship with Stanley, showed this incredible probing brain he has, He wants every line, every, which after all are very often instinctive impulses or artistic impulses, to be justified. He wants to understand, he wants to know, which can be very trying because in the end you become insecure.
Incidents like that won Kubrick the reputation of the filmmaker's filmmaker, someone who knew everybody's job and could do it at least as well as they could. Not everyone agrees. John Ward was a camera operator on Full Metal Jacket.
Everybody spoke to me before I did the film about, you know, this great auteur director, he's, you know, he's everything about everybody else's job. He doesn't actually know that much about everybody's job. He's read the books, he's heard the... It's almost like an actor who's read the script but hasn't actually understood the meaning of the lines. He knows how to recite the lines, but he doesn't know the detailed reasons behind it sometimes. And he'll really try and use this to sort of browbeat you into his position. But he does respect people who stand their ground, who are right and stand their ground.
Stanley is a basic bully. And as long as you recognise this and don't succumb to it, you're all right with Stanley.
Adrian Corry, who played in A Clockwork Orange.
I mean, he'll push people as far as he can. He's very interested in power. And the thing that also he's worked up for himself is the way of controlling the way a film is put out. He strikes fear into the distributors, into anybody working around him or with him. When I went and did interviews in America, he had them all taped and sent back to him. He would send notes and telexes and God knows what to unfortunate managers saying he hadn't liked an appearance, he'd liked this or that. They felt he was looking over their shoulder the whole time. And this is part of Kubrick's power play.
He can certainly be very cruel. And, of course, he's quite a chess player. And chess players are known to have these sort of rather strange personality quirks and very little human emotion. Strangely cold towards people. They keep lots of pets. And he seems to worry more about the dogs than he does about people.
It's very phony, actually. It's completely built up. It's an artificial thing. It's really rather all right. I mean, as long as you can put up with him. I used to send him up rotten. I used to call him Sidney Lumet a couple of times, and this drove him mad. So he used to call me Audrey, and we used to get on very well.
Stanley Kubrick isn't, as the Hollywood rubric goes, one of the warm people. Having elected to live in his mind, and according to the rules, less of humanity than of machines, he jettisons sentiment, sympathy, and concern.
The sixth member of the Discovery crew was not concerned about the problems of hibernation, for he was the latest result in machine intelligence, the HAL-9000 computer. Good afternoon, Hal. How's everything going?
Good afternoon, Mr. Aymer. Everything is going extremely well.
Hal, you have an enormous responsibility on this mission. In many ways, perhaps the greatest responsibility of any single mission element. Does this ever cause you any lack of confidence?
Let me put it this way, Mr. Aymer. The 9000 series is the most reliable computer ever made. No 9000 computer has ever made a mistake or distorted information. We are all, by any practical definition of the words, foolproof and incapable of error.
In 1964, Stanley Kubrick decided to make a film to accord with this philosophy, a science fiction epic.
Open the pod bay doors, please, Hal. Do you read me, Hal? Hello, Hal, do you read me? Hello, Hal, do you read me? Do you read me, Hal?
Affirmative, Dave. I read you.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do. This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
I don't know what you're talking about, Hal.
I know that you and Frank were planning to disconnect me. And I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
Where the hell did you get that idea, Hal?
Dave, although you took very thorough precautions in the pod against my hearing you, I could see your lips move.
Hal, I won't argue with you anymore. Open the doors.
Dave, this conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
In 2001, A Space Odyssey, Kubrick showed all human history as it must appear to anyone of rational mind, a kind of scientific experiment with man as the laboratory rat and the only truly sentient creature, a machine. In pursuit of this vision, he drove his collaborators to near breaking point. One assistant had already earned a reputation for inventiveness. While still a lowly tea boy, he had located one of the few desert landscapes in Britain, just outside Liverpool. His name was Andrew Birkin.
The following day, I was simply asked to go and turn up at the conference room, and there was the whole art department, Tony Masters and Ernie Archer and everyone else, and Stanley turned to them and said, you know, you spent £50,000 in 6 months and couldn't find a desert. How is it that the T-boy finds it within 24 hours?
To a man as preoccupied as Kubrick with the life of the mind, manipulating his colleagues was as stimulating as a chess game. In this, he had a notable precursor.
When he was planning Napoleon, he told me that apparently Napoleon used to keep notes as to who was in favour that week. So he'd have a list of his sort of 12 people around him. And on such and such a week, he would be number one. And then he was slightly moved down the list. So by the 12th list, the one who'd been at number one 12 weeks before was now panicking that he'd done something wrong in the great man's eyes. And I said, oh, but you do that, don't you? And it was true, he did. He kept a little list of people.
2001 didn't have the benefit of digital special effects. Everything had to be done by hand. Teams of art school students stippled stars on black backdrops using toothbrushes dipped in white paint. Models of the spaceships had to be wound laboriously on worm gears in shots that lasted for hours. The future was as handcrafted as a macrame plant holder.
The post-production was certainly over schedule, and I think somebody worked out that it was going to take till about 2001 to finish all the planned special effects. And Robert O'Brien, who was then the chairman or whatever, vice president of MGM, flew over from Culver City. And part of the reason Kubrick, of course, works in England is to be 6,000 miles away from the front office. Kubrick asked myself and a guy called Ivor Powell in on a Saturday, told us what was happening, and said, could you get some charts together? And I said, well, what do we put on the charts? He said, well, just anything, just make it look good. And I said, but to reflect what? He said, just to reflect the fact that we're going to finish making the movie, you know. And just use some imagination, a few pie graphs and pie charts and this, that and the other. So we sat down with all this Sasco gear and came up with some terrific looking charts, plastered them all around the conference office. And I said, I was off. He said, where are you going? I said, well, I'm going home, I finished. He said, no, you've got to be around to explain them. And this, we'd been told, would not be the case. But O'Brien and his four or five friends were in there, and Ivor and I had to go in and explain what was, in fact, total gobbledygook.
To underpin the film, Kubrick assembled one of the most memorable music scores of all time. That isn't the famous compendium of Strauss, Cacciatorian and Ligeti that appeared on the finished version of 2001, A Space Odyssey. That's the score composed by Alex North at the behest of the backers, MGM. Kubrick let North write it, record it, then, without telling him, used his own choice of music instead. North didn't find out until the premiere in New York, when he saw Kubrick's spaceships, fragile and white as Dresden, China, waltzing through space to this.
Mm-hmm.
Andrew Birkin remembers how this most felicitous choice of music came to be made.
The special effects sequences were mute, and every day we would sit in rushes and watch an hour of silent footage going backwards and forwards, because Stanley had a rock and roll gadget to look at it in reverse forward. And a chap called Colin Brewer, who was a production supervisor, had a habit of nodding off, and you'd hear this snoring sound, which was a little disturbing. And the projectionist just pulled me to one side as we were leaving and said, would it be a help if you put, you've got some old sort of music for pleasure records up in the projection box, how about sticking a few of them on? And I asked Kubrick, what did he think? He said, sure, fine. And so there was a very sort of hodgepodge of scratched old music. And about a week later, there was the Blue Danube over that shot of the space station turning. And when the lights came up at the end, he turned around and said, I wonder if that wouldn't be a nice idea. And surrounded by the sycophants that we all were, I suppose, he said, yeah, that's a great idea. But it took his kind of vision, I think, really to go for an idea like that. When it came out, I was working on Napoleon, and every time it opened in a new European city, I'd get a call from Stanley saying, leave whatever you're doing, get on a plane and fly to Zurich or fly to Paris or wherever, and check the print, check the projector, etc., etc. So one way and another, I saw the film in the cinema at least 50 or 60 times.
After 2001, Kubrick persuaded MGM to invest in the film he believed would establish him as the master director of the century, Napoleon. Anthony Burgess agreed to write the screenplay. Jack Nicholson would play the emperor who embodied Kubrick's philosophy of control. The Romanian army was hired to stand in for Napoleon's legions. Since there weren't enough soldiers for the purpose, they promised to call up more. With a carte blanche from Arts Minister André Malraux in his pocket, Andrew Birkin was sent to France at the height of the 1968 riots to gather material. But Napoleon was doomed. MGM went bankrupt, and no other studio would risk millions on such a project.
I remember coming back via Waterloo. He liked soil samples. So I took a sample of the earth from Waterloo. And in the little place I was staying the night, somebody offered me for sale Napoleon's death mask. So I bought it out of my living allowance. And when I got back, I presented it to Stanley as a Christmas present, Napoleon's death mask, which he took as a very bad omen. And about 2 weeks later, we all got our notice.
Kubrick retreated to the English countryside to plot strategy. Riots around the world had given impetus to a new kind of film and a new kind of director. Kubrick, past 40, risked looking like a dinosaur in this world of easy riders. He decided to show them of what he was capable. A Clockwork Orange succeeded spectacularly. Its pop art gloss on Anthony Burgess's Potboiler novel inflamed audiences as much as it infuriated Burgess, who, nevertheless, acknowledged that the film made both his reputation and, by catapulting the book to bestseller status, his fortune. Its star was Malcolm McDowell.
In the script, the gang came in to home and got the wife, threw bottles through windows, and that was kind of it, and then raped her. It was sort of, and beat him, and, you know, it was kind of boring. And we tried rehearsing it 5 days. Changed the furniture. Everyone was moved out to a marquee on the lawn. Of course, he started off. He came over to me and said, Mal, can you dance? I think we were fooling around, Warren and I, you know, with these wonderful boots on, paratroopers boots, I think, that he found in America. And I said, yeah, sure, why not? And I had the cane, and I started, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain. Boom! What a glorious feeling, happy again. And he was like, that's it.
And Stanley beetled off, and we thought, where the hell was he going to? And you know what he looks like, don't you, Stanley? He dresses entirely in black. It's black from head to foot and the black beard and everything. So he's like a little mole, really. And he beetled out of the room. And we found he was getting the rights for Singing in the Rain. And he kept saying, "You're doing the Debbie Reynolds part, Corrie. That's what you are using." I said, "Thanks a lot." And so we did it in the end in that kind of balletic way with the music. I never want to hear that song again.
For Kubrick, the price of renewed fame was notoriety. Stung by accusations of copycat attacks by lookalikes of the film's teenage gangsters, he withdrew the film, though not until it had ended its commercial run and had little more to earn for him. Pursued by death threats and muckraking headlines, he began using up his accumulated Napoleon research on an adaptation of Thackeray's obscure first novel, Barry Lyndon. Expecting Robert Redford to star, he ended up with Ryan O'Neill. The film sagged under the weight of its brocaded costumes, Irish stately homes and lapidary decor. "I like Barry Lyndon," said Steven Spielberg, an unabashed Kubrick admirer, "but for me, it was like going through the Prado without lunch." Had shown Kubrick that reinvigorating a debased form could win more plaudits than total originality. He thought of adapting Terry Southern's novel Blue Movie about the first full-budget Hollywood pornographic film, but lost his nerve. Instead, he decided to demonstrate to the directors of The Exorcist and The Omen how horror should be done. His subject was Stephen King's novel of a haunted, snowbound hotel, The Shining. The Shining did better both financially and critically than the disastrous Barry Lyndon, and Kubrick began to think about another fantasy subject. His imagination was caught by a story about a robot boy by British science fiction author Brian Aldiss. From the three-page fragment, Super Toys Last All Summer Long, Aldiss and Kubrick painstakingly began to construct a script called AI, for Artificial Intelligence. Aldiss quickly learned firsthand of Kubrick's exhausting methods of research.
For instance, he'd call in one of his assistants and say, "Get Hans Moravec on the line, the expert in AI." And so the guy would go off, come back in half an hour and say, "Stanley, Moravec isn't in the States right now. He's doing a lecture tour in Japan. Okay, get him in Japan." "Stanley, how would I do that?" Ring Warner out in Tokyo. Ring their Tokyo office. Tell them to get off their backsides. Tell them to find Moravec." And, you know, an hour later, Moravec would be on the line. "Hello, Stanley. Let your hands. Oh, what do you think about so-and-so-and-so-and-so? Well, couldn't we do so-and-so? Oh, shit. Well, could we do so-and-so-and-so? All right. Thanks." You know, I mean, he was relentless in his pursuit of what he actually wanted.
The writing dragged on for months, and Kubrick's interest waned. With the Vietnam War in full cry, he became obsessed with the intricacies of human behavior under the stress of combat. He acquired the rights to an obscure novel, The Short Timers, by a maverick veteran named Gustav Hasford, and persuaded Michael Herr, author of the classic Vietnam Chronicle, Dispatches, to write a script. He named it Full Metal Jacket, after a kind of ammunition. "It isn't the gun," says one character in the film, "but the hard heart that kills." More than ever determined to commit his vision to the screen with the greatest possible accuracy, Kubrick had become notorious for retaking scenes. Actors wept on The Shining at his demand for 30, 40, 50 takes. On Full Metal Jacket, it was no different. John Ward.
"Well, I had a conversation with Edda Ross, who played the lieutenant, and he said, you know, he didn't know how to play the scene any longer because he'd played it about 12 different ways, and he still hadn't got a clue from Stanley which was the preferred way. So he'd have to go in the following day and literally go through the gamut of the range of possibilities again for the next shot in the scene or whatever. So I don't know why Stanley goes on and on like that. I mean, it must make him very popular with Kodak, because it does burn film like it's going out of fashion. We did over 1 million feet of film on Full Metal Jacket altogether. It's almost as if he doesn't want to make a decision very often when you're working with him. He'll delay actually turning over and keep fussing about things that are almost totally unimportant, and carry on and carry on and carry on and carry on. And saying turnover is almost, you know, the hardest thing he can do, because that means he's had to have come to a decision.
Ward agrees, however, that Kubrick remained innovative and resourceful.
He'd made all sorts of odd decisions about how he wanted the film to look, and he particularly wanted it to look like those 60s documentary and news footage shots from Vietnam. And I think that's why we underexposed a bit, to flatten off the image, to give us that sort of slightly washed out look that you got out of those, because the light in Vietnam is particularly soft, very cloudy a lot of the time, and so that's what he wanted, is that not too much hard sun. We had huge 40 foot by 40 foot silk made up that when the wind caught it, blew the thing holding it over so he could keep the sun off.
Kubrick had become enamoured of the Steadicam, a harness that allowed an operator to carry the camera up and down stairs and to run with it, all the time retaining a rock-steady image.
The most satisfying shot, I think, is the one through the smoke towards the end of the film, where they're actually going into the building where the young girl sniper is picking off the guys in the platoon. And they throw out the smoke grenades and the burning buildings all on the left-hand side of the screen. And that was a really tricky one to do, because I couldn't see where I was going, and the ground is strewn with broken bricks and rubble. So it was quite a tricky shot to do. And I think Stanley, actually, at the end of the Rushes showing the following day, said that, I think he actually used the word brilliant, and Dougie Milson was most upset, because having done 4 films with Stanley, Dougie said he barely says thank you to me, let alone brilliant.
The strain of making a film like Full Metal Jacket could be enormous, but Kubrick found his own characteristic way of pacing himself.
He certainly was very tired at times, and Stanley is an insomniac anyway. I mean, he tends to stay up at night and watch television. Bad television seems to be one of his fortes, is staying up late at night and watches television. And the following day, he seems to be absolutely washed out. And he'd give us something impossible to do for a couple of hours, or something possible but would take a couple of hours to do. And then he'd go off and have a little kip in the Winnebago while we all got on with the bits that he wanted us to do.
From Clockwork Orange on, Kubrick worked under a lucrative contract with Warner Brothers. Once he delivered a script, the studio left him in peace until he delivered the completed film. Anyone who tried to bypass this agreement met with a typically Kubrick dusty answer. And an answer, moreover, which he made sure the whole unit could hear.
We had 2 walkie-talkie channels. There was Stanley's personal channel, which meant that the first AD and Dougie Milson and the designer Anton Furst and people like that had to have that channel. But the problem was the rest of the crew had to have another channel. And so some of the heads of department were having to carry 2 walkie-talkies, A, so they could talk to Stanley, and B, so they could talk to the rest of the crew. So it became a bit convoluted at times. So Margaret Adams called Stanley on his personal channel when he was in the Winnebago, and said that Paul Hitchcock, who was then the head of the Warner Suite at Pinewood Studios, was there to see him. And we, of course, heard this because we were standing by the first AD or Dougie or whoever had one of Stanley's channels on. And Stanley came out of the Winnebago and walked up to the first, took his other walkie-talkie off his belt, so now the whole crew can hear, called Margaret back and said, "Tell Paul Hitchcock I'm too busy to see him and never to come to my set again." And Paul got in his car and went back to Pinewood. And a few weeks later, I saw Paul. He said, "Look, Warner Brothers tell me to visit Stanley Kubrick's set. So I go down to Stanley Kubrick's set. Stanley tells me to piss off. I piss off. Everybody's happy." "Oh, well, everybody's heard about the bird.
Kubrick released Full Metal Jacket in 1987. Half a success with critics, and less so with audiences, who felt the same material had already been covered in films like Platoon and Apocalypse Now. The film has grown in stature over the decade, its sparseness and irony an agreeable antidote to the operatic vision of Oliver Stone and Francis Coppola. One feels Kubrick's scorn in the choice of music. For Apocalypse Now, Coppola chose Wagner. For Platoon, Stone used Samuel Barber's doleful adagio. But surely there's more of the reality of Vietnam in Kubrick's choice, the manic, quacking, surfing bird.
Deal was ridiculous because the amount of weeks that I devoted to Kubrick were out of all proportion to the putative deal.
Frederick Raphael, Kubrick's most recent scriptwriter, reflecting in tranquility beside a fountain in his Dordoin home.
He did drive me completely crazy from time to time, but we did get on very well, and I did respect him. The curious thing, I mean, I did a section of 45 pages, sort of rather quickly. And he said, well, I'd like to see, you know, show me what you're doing. And I said, well, I hate to do that, but I will do it for you. I mean, I made exceptions with Stanley of an order which I've never made for anybody else. Sent in the pages. And he called our house just before one Christmas. And he said, Freddie. So I said, yeah, I said, Stanley, okay. Listen, he said, I've read the pages. I'm absolutely thrilled. So I thought, oh. I sort of, would you say that again? Yeah, I'm absolutely thrilled, okay. After that, we had less happy conversations, like, I don't like that scene, huh? So what didn't you like about it? I don't know. But what would you like done about it? I wish I could help you. I don't know. I just don't like it. Would you do it again? So it was like I wrote 50 movies for Kubrick. Thousands of pages. Some of which he would say, oh, yeah, pretty good scene, okay? Then I would write another scene, and he would say, you know what? He said, it's a great scene, huh? I mean, that's a great scene. It's, oh, good. Yeah, it's a great scene for Bogart and Sidney Greenstreet, okay? But I can't get them. So, would you do it again? He'd say, you know, I'd say, you know what she sounds like? Sounds like kind of Barbara Streisand playing a New York hooker, okay? Kind of goes, boom, 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 boom. You know, I don't want that. I mean, I don't want Barbara Streisand in the movie, okay?
The film Raphael was writing, and which Kubrick has taken more than 2 years to shoot, is the one we'll finally see this summer, Eyes Wide Shut. Adapted from a novel by the Viennese writer Arthur Schnitzler, it's a project Kubrick first announced in 1971 while awaiting the release of Clockwork Orange. The story of a Vienna doctor and his wife, their sexual fantasies and the doctor's involvement, real or imagined, in an aristocratic orgy of masked waltzing beauties and their consorts, has been transplanted to New York and updated to the present day. After that, the film is cloaked in a typically impenetrable Kubrick shroud of secrecy. John Ward visited the set of the film, which stars two of Hollywood's ruling royalty, Nicole Kidman and Tom Cruise.
I know that there was a scene of Tom Cruise coming through a door, which they shot 95 takes, and the bizarrest reasons were given for why they went again. Tom didn't look early enough, Tom looked too early, and one wonderful incident when Tom and he were looking at the video playback, and again using this business of trying to put people off their stroke, trying to sort of put them off balance, he looked at Tom and said, you know, if you stick with me, I can make you a big star, with that sly smile on his face that he always used to use in these sort of things. And of course Tom was, but am I a big star? And it was, and you knew at that point Stanley had done exactly what he wanted to do. He just throw him off balance, just that little bit. And it's all, it's real mind game stuff. I mean, he does love playing mind games with people.
Stanley, please ring me when you get this message. It's 657. You know my number.
What to make of Kubrick in his 70th year, as he completes what may well be his last film? He has his deficiencies, true. He distrusts language and has little sense of human behaviour. But against this, one must rank his miraculously accurate eye, surely the equal of any great painter, and his vision of the world as a microscope slide on which we humans wriggle and strive, blind to the rules of logic and entropy. Above all, he is a man of the cinema. It's his church, in which he's lived and worshipped with absolute fidelity for more than half a century. The images produced by that worship are indelible. elevator doors opening to gush dark blood in The Shining, the sky filthy with war above the battles of Full Metal Jacket, the gleaming black space of the war room in Strangelove, Sue Lyons' coolly assessing stare in Lolita, Barry and Lady Lyndon kissing in silence in the moonlight in Barry Lyndon. With these images, Kubrick changed the look of cinema forever. Making a rare appearance last year, admittedly on video, to accept the D.W. Griffith Award from the Directors Guild of America, Kubrick articulated his philosophy of film with a typical absence of melodrama.
Anyone who has ever been privileged to direct a film also knows that although it can be like trying to write War and Peace in a bumper car in an amusement park, when you finally get it right, there are not many joys in life that can equal the feeling.
Stanley was written and presented by John Baxter. The reader was Kerry Shale. The programme was produced by David Perry and was a Periscope production for the BBC.